Hello.
Hello.
This is Gabriella.
And this is Claudette.
And you're listening to
Erratic Dialogue.
Erratic Dialogues.
Sex, literature, and thermodynamics. These are some of the ideas explored in Tom Stoppard's Icadia, written and first performed in 1993 at the National Theatre in London. As with all of Stoppard's plays, ideas are king. In Icadia, commentary on chaos theory, 19th century gardening, academic rivalry, waltzing and Newtonian physics are all conflagrated into sparkling, shimmering repartee. Yet, for all the plays to rebuild fixtures, the heart, that unpredictable, maddening thing, cannot be ignored. Depending on your sample size, Icadia is generally acknowledged to be Stoppard's masterpiece, yet it's also been accused as an exercise in intellectual indulgence. Last night, Gabby and I had the privilege of seeing Icadia in a new production by the Sydney Theatre Company, directed by Richard Cottrell, and starring, among others, Ryan Corr, Blazey Best, and Andrea Dimitriades. This is a play that I've lived with many, many years, and I think I've spent a significant time in my life proselytizing about it to other people, as Gabby would know.
Yes.
But this is the first time that you, Gabby, have seen it, and I think just this past week is the first time you've actually encountered the play. Mm-hmm. So I'm dying to hear what you think and what you thought about this particular production.
I remember when I first got to know you all those many years back, yeah. you sent me a digital copy of the production, an audio production. You were like, yeah. You must listen to this. I was like, no, I don't have time. And I feel like such a fool because I look back and this is just my... You know, this is so many things that I like and I'm interested in, kind of jam-packed into 1-2.5 hour brilliant production. Yeah, I really, really liked it. It's difficult to find something that is so... It's like a perfect slice of sponge cake.
Yeah.
But it has like a lemon custard filling, not the traditional jam. Yeah.
That's a good analogy.
I mean, it's just, it's perfect. I mean, if you like...
Period drama.
Period drama. If you're interested in the 19th century, if you're interested in intellectual questions and theoretical questions, if you're interested in science, it's got it all.
Philosophical questions about science versus art and, you know, history and if you're a romantic.
Yes.
In both the little R and the big R.
If you're interested in gardens, if you're interested in gender, if you're interested in the state of contemporary academia, like it's really just the perfect confluence of so many things that I like to argue about. So it was perfect for me.
Well, I'm so happy and it's very gratifying. I mean, it would have been an interesting conversation if you hadn't.
I mean, if I didn't like it, then, you know, you would know that a reptile had taken over my my body.
And the audio production that Gabby's mentioning, that's the original cast that was recorded by BBC, and it's a bit tricky to get, but if you find it, it's well worth your time. But actually, you had read the play first.
Yes.
So tell me about that experience, about reading the play, which actually I feel, we watched it with a couple of people, and I think the general consensus was that actually this is a type of play that perhaps is better to have read before you have gone to see the show.
Yeah.
What do you think?
It's interesting. As a reading process, it was actually very pleasurable to read it. And I spend a lot of my time reading plays.
Mm.
This is the third play I've read this week. So it was actually really, really lovely to read. Because it reads like a piece. It's got a lot of novel, and I mean that in both senses of the word, elements. Mm-hmm. And it's very witty. There's so much wordplay that you kind of get sucked into it. But it's interesting because you wonder... With Tom Stoppard always. I mean, what I find very interesting about his theatre is that it really brings back the kind of oral nature of the theatre. There's this expectation that the audience has not come so much to see a visual production, but an oral one.
Yeah.
And that's going back to a very long tradition of, you know, English theatre. Because, you know, when the theatre started to be created, well, the kind of the early modern incarnation of it, the early modern people would say that they're hearing a play, they're not seeing it.
Yeah.
And for us, you know, when listening to the play last night, you really have to pay attention, otherwise you can very quickly become lost in all the very witty things that people that the characters are saying.
Well, the fate of a character is, like, just given a single line.
Yes.
And if you had missed it,
then
the ending would have completely gone over your head.
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, I have heard criticism about this play that it's, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, there have been reviews, even reviews for this particular production, about how it's just purely for, like, intellectual showmanship, just an exercise so that audience members can feel very smart and witty because they're participating in this event. I feel like, number one, I don't understand this, like, anti-intellectual position and the notion that just because something is challenging and not fully comprehensible to you when you first encounter it, it's not necessarily an indication of a lack of quality in the text. Maybe it's you.
Did you leave a comment on this review?
No, I didn't. I didn't, but I see you inwardly needed a cup of tea after Reddit. And then another thing I feel like it's completely ignoring, I think, if it was done by a lesser playwright who really did not have a firm hand and just an amazing idea in terms of plot, then yes, I would agree that perhaps it's an exercise in intellectual indulgence. But I mean, just the fact that the plot in and of itself works well, so well together. I just feel like people who don't really see the genius of the piece are kind of missing out, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think it's not an issue of not seeing the genius of it. It's more like feeling offended by it.
Yeah.
I mean, because we live in a cultural climate where people who are overtly intellectual and proud of it are demonized because they are looked down upon because they're perceived to be looking down on others. But, you know, being in the audience last night, people were laughing at all the smart jokes.
Yeah.
People were laughing at references to things. So that shows that there is definitely a space in our community for these sorts of things and that people want this kind of thing. So I think, you know, yes, the play's hard. Yes, you have to pay attention. But, you know, if you are able to pay attention every week to Q&A, then I think you can have 2.5 hours of your life where you're challenged. And this idea that we go to the theater not to be challenged, like, that is deeply, that goes against the very root of what this cultural artifact is about.
Yeah.
I think it's, yes, there are a lot of very difficult things in this play. I mean, for me in particular, the kind of mathematical elements of it and the scientific elements, you know, I really have to listen. I have to pay attention because I do not have a background in thermodynamics. But then the play actually explains it really, really well. Yeah. But I felt when I was watching it, it kind of, you know, Stoppard has that very typical rolling wit and the characters talk really quickly to get their witty jibes out that are actually, like, you know, a jibe and a half. And so they have to talk really quickly, actually, so that, you know, when you're making a comeback, nobody can talk over you. And it's kind of like that Shakespeare in Love quality of the fun and the joy and taking pleasure in anachronism.
And there's a lot there's a lot of puns and there's a lot of wordplay. Yeah, I mean, Tom Stoppard is just a brilliant linguist at the heart of it as well.
Yes.
In addition to a person with a sort of an incredibly febrile imagination, he's just a great wordsmith. Just the pleasure of just listening to his dialogue is is one of the amazing things about Arcadia.
Definitely. But I mean, like, it irritates me that, you know, there's this expectation that if you're cultured, you should go and see a Shakespeare production every year. Why is that accepted intellectualism, but, like, Tom Stoppard is seen as, like, too big for his boots?
Yeah, I don't know. Because this is actually, I think, this is the first Arcadia production that Sydney Theatre Company has done since the original production in 1994.
Wow.
And I feel like it's, in terms of production costs, it would be very easy. It's all in this one set. But you just need really, really good actors.
But
it just goes to show that Arcadia really hasn't made much of an impact on the Sydney theatre scene.
But it's interesting because, you know, Stoppard is so loved and lauded in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, why is it that, you know, what does it say about us? Does this just reinforce that we are a colonial backwater? I think yes and no because, sorry, I answered my own question there. yes and no because on the one hand, there is this criticism from a more conservative, anti-intellectual, you know, or maybe they just need to sell reviews. Sell papers. They wrote a nasty review. Or maybe on the other hand, there was definitely a full audience.
Mm. So I guess before we get into the nitty gritty of the play, I've just noticed that we haven't actually discussed the plot of the play.
Yes.
So did you want to give
a quick summary? So the plot works in two historical timelines. The first, the play opens in the year 1809.
Yes.
So this is the second wave of Romanticism, and it's about a girl called Thomasina, who's 13, and she just happens to be a mathematical prodigy, potentially even a genius. And she's with her tutor, Septimus, and they're kind of nutting out what is a carnal embrace, which it turns out is when you wrap your arms around a, you know, leg of lamb. So there's that element, and it's their story, and it's a story of her intellectual development. It's a story about
his discovery of her, that he's tutoring in essence a genius.
Yes. And her discovery of the second law of thermodynamics long before its time, or chaos theory. But
this idea of like nature as something irregular, nature not following the laws of Newton, which was his classical geometry.
And determinism. Yeah. Interspersed within Thomasina and Septimus's story are scenes from the early 90s where two academics are basically trying to figure out what happened.
Yeah, what happened to Thomasina, what happened to Septimus Hodge.
Yeah, and what is this, in this fictional estate, how the big players, or some of the big players of Romanticism, whether they were there, the implications that this would have, how Lord Byron in particular comes into it. And their story is really about the cruelty of knowledge.
Yeah.
In a way.
And the sort of inability of, even if you're a historian, you can never encapsulate, like the loss of heat.
Mm.
You can never, once the present or history has been lost, you can't recreate it, you can't recapture it. And actually, your margin of error is like as wide as a universe, essentially.
Yeah. So the two parts of the plot eventually come to start mirroring each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question for you is what is the nature of mirrors and recursion within the play? What does that have to do with the plot, with the structure, with the themes?
Well, it's one of the main sort of mathematical theories that is bandied about, or not theories, but practices that is bandied about, is this notion of the iterative algorithm.
Yes.
So that's the idea that you take a formula, you input a number in that formula that gives you a result, and then you use that result back into the formula, and eventually what you have is a pattern.
Mm.
And what scientists have discovered, there's actually, in the disorder of nature, lots of things in nature actually act according to a fundamental formula. So like snowflakes, if you look at the way snowflakes are arranged, you can see that the wider snowflake is composed of smaller snowflakes of exactly the same structure. And then in terms of numbers, you can see any sort of natural phenomena that eats its own numbers, like, for example, measles epidemic or the weather, for example. Underlying what seems chaos is actually acting towards a formula. So that goes to your question about mirror images, because I feel like iterated algorithm can also be seen as a metaphor for history repeating itself or having parallels. So you have characters in the 1809 section of Arcadia, such as Thomasina, and it's repeated again in the future. You have this character named Chloe who's a very different character, but in some ways is very similar. And you see that the chaos that is happening in the 1809 period, where people are like sleeping with each other and like all this type of bed hopping, and that sort of like chaos is reflected again in the modern, or the 1990s section. So I think that the sort of parallelism in the plot structure of the play is just another way of reflecting this sort of iterated algorithm. I don't know. That's my theory.
I think you're spot on. And I think what's really interesting about it is that kind of becomes a mise en abyme. I can't pronounce French. Funnily enough, in the restaurant last night, the French waiter made me try and repronounce something that I'm pronouncing correctly. So I'm not even going to try and pronounce that correctly.
It'll probably be in your essay.
Then. Yes, definitely. These are the kinds of things, refractions of what I'm interested in. Yeah, so it's this idea that in pieces of art, they create like mirrors within themselves in order to reflect back on themselves, the nature of the media, the nature of art, the most famous example of this is Velázquez's Les Marinas.
We talked about that in the other podcast.
Did
the
I? Great Okay. Arts. Yeah. Well, this is what I come back to all the time. Yeah, so in that painting, there is a mirror held up back onto the viewer. And we take the role, we're looking into the mirror, looking at the painting, whilst, you know, Velázquez himself is in the painting, painting us. Looking at the painting that he's painting.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant. And, you know, one of the reasons why they say it's the greatest piece of art of all time. Yeah. Up for debate. Anyway, I think Arcady's doing that too. And I think it's by creating a series of mirrors within the text, it's actually reflecting back on, you know, the nature of the media that it's presented in, the nature of drama and how all drama is very referential. So Hannah's quest is to find out who the hermit of Sidley Park is. Yeah. And for those who don't know, at the height of Romanticism, they would, you know, create hermitages in the grounds of estates and stick a hermit in.
Before Romanticism, it was the height of neoclassical sort of aesthetics.
Yes.
So order, symmetry, that
classicism.
Sort of classicism. Mm. And then Romanticism happened and the world was upended.
Yes.
And now it was all about irregular things.
Yes.
So nature outsprung waterfalls, crags, and like hermitages.
And they describe the hermit as being this like mad fool or this fool that speaks reason. And you can't be on a stage and talk about a fool that speaks reason and not think King Lear, right?
Yeah.
So there's all this kind of intertext happening. And as a great British play that's very self-aware of its great British playness, it's like making references to other great British plays, I think. And I think it's kind of commenting on, you know, how we view history and our kind of stake in the past. And when Stop Art is being consciously anachronistic, I think he's creating a world that we want to see. This play starts out as the kind of typical Oscar Wilde meets Jane Austen kind of witty dialogue.
Yeah.
But then it goes completely over itself and tragedy happens.
Yeah.
Science happens. Things that we usually expect to see. I mean, it starts out and you're like, oh, I'm in The Importance of Being Earnest.
Yeah,
I know exactly what's going on here. I know this tone. But then it goes into a territory that you don't expect. And I think in a way it's using mirrors in order to break the mirror that we're of cultural expectation.
Yeah, well, this notion, this idea of chaos and this notion of entropy, which is the sort of the death of the universe through a lack of heat, or the idea of like a ball breaking a window, heat, friction comes in and it distorts everything. So, I mean, people like to think of the present or future or history or time, really, as the ideal timeline is a straight line.
So this is Arcadia is a play that has a lot of strong and intellectual female characters.
Yes.
What do you think about that? Is that normal for theatre? Is that normal for the plays that we see?
I think it must be unusual because I think these particular characters play a huge role into why I love this play. Mm. And Thomasine is probably one of my favourite female characters in literature. And I think it's just unique because rarely ever have, you know, these sort of female characters with this sort of intellectual rigour.
Mm.
And that's really, really appealing to me. And I do think that Thomasina and Hannah in the present period, they're really, really strong characters who always have a firm hand on the males that are around them. I guess they're never sort of lost, you know, they never find themselves beholden to to the male intellect that surrounds them. And in both cases, they are faced with somebody of like intellectual rigor, but they hold their own, and I find that really appealing.
Yes.
To bring back your question to you, what do you think? Do you think that these characters are unusual, or am I just
I completely agree with you. I do think that they are very unusual, and I think it's actually very refreshing, especially because it's common in, you know, especially in the representation of academics and intellectuals. you know, that's gendered male implicitly,
yeah,
explicitly, yeah, in our culture. And you know, this is the year before Possession by A.S. Byatt came out, and that's another example of a female academic who's struggling, you know, uses questions of gender in order to think about what it means to be, you know, an academic and in the pursuit of knowledge. And I think Hannah is a very interesting character because she doesn't let men overtake her, and she doesn't let her quest for knowledge become sexualized at all.
Yeah.
Ever. But then is there something sexist in that, on that hand of Tom Stoppard? Because he doesn't let her, in order to let her be smart, she's utterly defleshed.
Is she really?
Or can I play devil's advocate to myself and say that it's liberating that we have a story about an intellectual woman that doesn't end in like love.
Happily. Because I mean, even to a certain extent, Thomasina's story has eventually evolved to a romance.
Yeah.
But a romance that's founded on a shared mutual passion for ideas, but a romance nonetheless.
Yeah.
But Hannah sort of avoids that. Mm. And I think I would have been disappointed if, you know, for example, she got together with Valentine or whatever.
But not even. But what did you think of the actress who played Hannah?
I thought she was really, really good.
Yeah. But how do you, I thought her, she was fabulous in the role, but I had problems with, I guess, the directorial choices of her. How she was kind of, when I read the play, so there's a character called Bernard.
Mm-hmm.
He is the male academic, and he has your typical, stereotypical, wears plaid and little bow ties, very arrogant, self-assured, vocally dominating, you know, just sexually...
incredibly condescending.
Yeah, makes sexually, you know, kind of creepy comments and gets away with it because he's a clever man. And when I read it, he would say some, you know, these awful lines of course you didn't find it, you silly bitch, or stuff like that. And in the text, that reads extremely vociferous.
Mm-hmm.
But then in production, it was like, oh, ha-ha, more of a joke, even though that's an extremely sexist and vile thing to say. And maybe it was a directorial choice to just have Hannah kind of laugh it off. But it, for me, in the text, she seemed a lot more kind of cutting and cruel almost and cold but as a way to deflect Bernard, whilst in production, she seemed a lot more comic. Which I thought was interesting.
Do you agree with that choice? Or for example,
I mean, it's a choice I that the director had, and he isn't wrong, but I don't think it's what I would have chosen.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I don't quite like about the play is the figure of Chloe.
Right.
Who is the aristocratic daughter in the 1990s. Yep. And she is not the mathematical prodigy that Thomasina is. And she's used a lot for in terms of presenting class. It's a very mannered sort of character. And also she's the sort of butt of a lot of sexual jokes well. I guess if you just focus on her character, you could argue that the play is quite misogynistic in its treatment of women. That's only luckily counterpointed by with Hannah and Thomasina. And Lady Croom. I don't know exactly what to think about the sort of almost blasé misogyny that pervades the play. Is that you know, an intentional ironizing to show how sexist this sort of academic culture is? Or do you think it was just a product of its time and that sort of sexual jokes were just, you know, par for course?
Well, I think when it comes to these sorts of things, it's dependent on who the audience is laughing at.
Yeah.
Are we laughing at the character's misogyny, or are we laughing at the character who's the target of it?
Yeah.
You know, and I think there are moments where we're definitely laughing at Bernard because he's so backwards and he's such a stereotype of academic culture.
The way he calls Hannah dear girl, and with that horrible part where he calls her book a novelette.
And you know, one of the intellectual problems of the play is the way in to their relationship is Hannah writes a book on Lady Caroline Lamb, who was the lover of Lord Byron. She was the one who called him mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And she was she wrote in her own right. Mm-hmm. And Hannah's book was basically about reclaiming Lamb as a literary figure.
Because she's gotten quite a short shrift in history, today.
Yes.
And she's just seen as this irrational woman who could have corrupted
crazy love letters. You know? Yeah. And Bernard kind of gives Hannah a lot of
slack. And Bernard is an academic of Byron. That's his specialty. Yeah.
And this, you know, I think Stoppard's very aware of the fact that, you know, the humor behind Bernard being a Byron scholar, because Byron is the ultimate misogynist romantic, right? I don't think Byron was on the side of women at all. No. And it's interesting that this whole story circles around the non-present figure of Byron, rather than Shelley or Wordsworth or Coleridge or Keats. Like, it's none of them, because they don't hold the same kind of idea in our cultural memory of that Lord Byron has in particular. Well, what do you think the lack of Lord Byron in the play? The ghost of Byron is always present, but he's never present.
Well, I love it, because I feel like if an actor had to play Byron and insert it, it would make it, like, it would lose a bit of its sort of transcendent sort of qualities. It would become sort of like a parody of the period, as opposed to this wonderful sort of ironic leitmotif of it. So I'm really glad that he's not in there, but he's sort of this ghost that so pervades. Well, because I guess, you know, when we think of romanticism, Byron is often he encapsulates the brilliant bits of romanticism, but also
it's
sort of
poetry.
So he's just a figurehead for the age.
So a lot of this play is very conscious about anachronism, and it uses the huge table, the center set, as a kind of a locus for this anachronism. The things that the characters leave on the table in the 19th century stays there up until the 20th. What do you think of the nature of time in Arcadia?
Well, I think that's one of the best things about the play is its presentation of time, because time is not linear. It's like chaos. It's like a jumble of things. It's multi-dimensional. And I mean, there are more like time travel pop cultural products today, but I mean, Doctor Who. But I think Arcadia really encapsulates time really, really well. And also how history and time is that relationship really, really well.
Well, it kind of begs the question of, to what extent is history a construction by us?
Yeah.
I mean, is this play a construction? I mean, it is. It's art is a construction of the present and of history. But this play is like,
well, it's showing you that, like, we tend to believe that history as truth, I guess. History and truth is often used as a synonym, like used for the same thing. But in actual fact, history is a narrative. It's a reconstruction. It's a narrative, a very skillful one that is rooted in empirical evidence. Yeah. Well, the best history is, but some historians don't follow that. But history is a narrative, and like all narratives, it will take the things that suit it and eliminate or ignore the things that don't suit it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's also very interesting considering the plot in the 20th century, because that's what the academics do.
Yeah.
Bernard constructs a version of history that's very convenient for him. That's a story that he wants to be able to sell as an academic, a point that he's trying to make about Lord Byron. But it's shown to us very clearly that history is just, you know, to what extent is what academics doing just a construction? And,
well, it goes to another central point of the play, which is it all trivial? It's like, is art, is philosophy, is history all trivial because it's not rooted in the empirical inquiry like science is? And Bernard and Valentine, the scientists in the play, have this warring sort of exchange of words about it. I mean, it's a blow too if you're like a historian. It's like this notion that it's all trivial. But in the play, Hannah also says it doesn't really matter anyway. It's the wanting to know
that matters. It's the search. It's the search for knowledge that's the most important. And I think Stoppard reveals the falseness at the heart of that dichotomy of the art versus science dichotomy, because in Thomasina's depiction of the world, her mathematical depiction of the world, it's represented as something that's quite beautiful and artful.
Yeah.
So the two things come together. They're intrinsically linked. And Bernard is the real fool, because he's the one that doesn't want to see how everything adds up.
Yeah.
While someone like Hannah or Valentine or Thomasina or Septimus can.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that there's a competition between the different forms. Yeah. Everything should be, dare I say it, collaborative and reliant upon each other in order to create a fuller and more beautiful world.
Well, speaking of collaboration, actually, at the root of it, the relationships that are successful are the ones that deal with collaboration. Because, like, Thomasina collaborates with Septimus in 1809, and then it's only through discussion with Valentine, and it's only through, like, Gus is this silent young boy who is also a genius in the modern period, who is able to unearth things in the house that that give Hannah conclusive proof of her theories. Yeah, so it's this idea that, like, you need other people to formulate.
Well, things aren't created in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And for Bernard uses other people, but he doesn't rely on other people.
Yeah.
And he has this very vacuous idea of what knowledge is. Well, what I also think is interesting about how Stoppard creates history in this play is that, I don't know, the theatre, the idea of theatre, watching theatre is based on this idea of, like, the suspension of disbelief, which is the idea that when you watch theatre, you have to willingly suspend your disbelief. You need to be able to say, okay, I know that this isn't real. I know that these are actors, but I will believe that this is real in this moment. And I think he's saying something about our creation of the past. We have to, subconsciously, I guess, suspend our disbelief when we watch things about history in order to recreate it. And we've don't like to think about the fact that it is actually completely historically incorrect.
Well, even a documentary, lots of people think documentaries are like a complete facsimile of what had happened, but they're not.
Yeah.
They're as manipulated and as created as any fiction, really.
Yeah. And it's interesting that Stoppard gives us a time of history. I mean, is this post-BBC Pride and Prejudice when he wrote this?
This was just before.
Just before. But still, like, it's
already the sort of, like, cottage industry of Jane Austen.
Yeah.
It was quite fervent.
Yeah, and it's just, I don't know, in periods of English history, you have the, you know, late 1590s and the early 1800s, and those are the two periods that are, like, the most, there's so much iconography around them, you know?
Why do you think that is?
Because those are the times of the great British genius. I mean, Shakespeare's in the 1600s and all the attendant people around him. Then during the early 19th century, you have the next great string of British genius and the creation of British art forms that we like the most.
Yeah.
So I think that's exactly the reason, because it's the people that are the most mysterious to us and also the people who create the things that are part of our culture.
Yeah.
So we'd like to tell stories about the stories that create us.
So would you argue that Tom Stoppard chose this period because of that? Or could he have said it in any other...
Oh, no. I think he chose it for a reason because we're fascinated with Lord Byron.
Yeah.
You know, we still are. This play was written, 15 years back?
Yeah.
We still love Lord Byron. He's so... You know, I had a phase when I was 16 where I loved Lord Byron. You know, she walks in Beauty like the night. I mean, how can you not just be head over heels? Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know is the story that every, you know, period drama is based on. So it's when we look back on that time of history, I mean, in a way, like, it's a cynical move, because by situating himself within the period of the great British genius, Stoppard represents himself as a great British genius, right? He puts himself up there with Wordsworth, etc.
Yeah, well, I mean, luckily his gifts match his ego.
Yes.
But yeah, it could have been a very different outcome.
Yeah.
If you had somebody who didn't have the faculty to mimic the period.
Yes,
I guess. Indeed. He and A.S. Byatt.
Yeah, yes, definitely. A lot of critics say that Arcadia is the best play written in the 20th century, or the latter half of the
20th century.
What do you think? Does it stand up there with The Crucible, Streetcar Named Desire, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Waiting for Godot? None of which are happy plays.
No. Well, actually, it's not really a happy play either.
But it's comic.
Yeah.
Angels in America.
Well, I think it's just so different from those, like, the earlier period, so anything pre-19th. 60s, 70s, I think. I honestly think I don't know necessarily if I think it's the greatest play ever written, but I definitely think it's up there. I mean, I hate to, I mean, not, as you know, we're not so big fans of the canon.
We don't believe in creative hierarchies. No. And yet, let us decide whether this is the greatest play.
But I do think it's... I do think there's, in terms of what it does and what it does so well, there is, really isn't any equal to it in recent times.
I think this play is like the height of postmodernism, right? This is the apotheosis of the cultural movement.
Yeah.
It doesn't get better than this.
This sort of reflective, comedy-wise,
yeah.
This sort of reflective, sort of deconstructing, you know, history and literature and academia and then science as well. Yeah.
It's happy postmodernism.
Yeah, basically. It's postmodernism done really well.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes can be...
It's very hard to achieve.
Yeah, I think... I love this play.
Mm.
This is my absolute favourite play. But even beyond that, I think it is... I definitely think it's his masterpiece.
Mm.
And I think it is a masterpiece of that sort of late 20th century.
Yeah.
And I don't really think that we have had yet a play that matches it for what it does.
Mm. Yes. Potentially Hamilton now.
Yes.
Yeah, did I just open that box?
a new thing for me to proselytize now that Arcadia is out of the way. Yeah, well, actually, now that we're
talking about Hamilton,
I think the thing that I love about this play is that, and it sort of mimics my favorite types of literary criticism. Mm. Literary criticism is not just, you know, saying your own opinion.
Mm.
It's being able to fuse all these different elements together to construct something really, a wonderful narrative that is quite unique.
Yes.
And I think often the best art does the same thing.
Mm.
They take all the strands together and to form something that is not easily replicated. So, in, you know, Arcadia's sense, it's fusing the science of the age with an exploration of history and postmodernism. Yeah. And for Hamilton, it is fusing today's sort of, like, consciousness of people of colour and the immigration experience and the sort of dissolving of American identity with, you know, America's past.
In a
quite a dark past, but also a past that is like emblazoned on every street corner in America.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like, exactly. Yeah. Like the reason why I love Hamilton is exactly the same as the reason why I like Arcadia.
It's recreating and reclaiming history in a way that's still very reliant upon it.
Yeah.
So you're still learning something whilst being challenged about the nature of the views that you might have already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you haven't heard of what Hamilton is, it's a...
Look it up.
look it up, and I highly doubt that you would have encountered it in some way, but it's basically, it's a hip-hop musical about the first Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton. He was a contemporary of Jefferson. And,
yes.
But it's sung by a Puerto Rican man, and everybody is... played by basically a person of color. But anyway, it's like...
Yes. Apparently, you know, tickets now, you can't get a ticket for them, like, the next 3 years, and they've gone up to, like, $1,000 each or something ridiculous like that. So,
So, I assume that Miranda is, like, the new stuffer.
Yeah.
So I'm really, really glad that we finally tackled it after all these years.
We finally did Arcadia. You know, it came, like Arcadia itself, it came full circle.
Yeah.
You told me about it, and here we are.
So I'm really, really glad that we were able to discuss it.
Thanks for listening to Braddock Dialogues. You can read our essays about Arcadia or check out our other episodes on www.erraticdialogues.com. That's dialogue spelt with a G-U-E-S. Follow us and get in touch on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to us on iTunes.